Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, July 15th. As some of you know, an open letter published in Harper's Magazine last week has sparked debate and a published response letter among people who think about free speech and about racism and about what some people call cancel culture. We have two guests standing by for a dialogue, a signatory of each of the two letters. The original was called A Letter on Justice and Open Debate. It began by applauding what it calls the powerful protest for racial and social justice, leading to overdue demands for police reform, along with wider calls for greater equality and inclusion across our society. They praise that. But then it objects to what the letter calls forces of illiberalism in a new set of moral attitudes that tend to weaken debate in favor of ideological conformity. The letter was signed by a long list of really well-known people, including Gloria Steinem, Wynton Marsalis, Noam Chomsky, Fareed Zakaria, Margaret Atwood, Salman Rushdie, Bill T. Jones, Michelle Goldberg, Andrew Solomon, Zephyr Teachout, Nell Irvin Painter, J.K. Rowling, and others. There were also some more conservative signatories, like New York Times columnists David Brooks and Barry Weiss. Weiss resigned from the Times yesterday, alleging, quote, constant bullying by colleagues who disagree with my views, unquote, among other issues. We'll touch on the Barry Weiss story with our two guests as well. The open letter that came in response to the one in Harper's is called A More Specific Letter on Justice and Open Debate. The response letter criticizes the first one for failing to deal with the problem of power, who has it and who does not. The response letter signers are generally not famous, and they say that's part of the point. The respondents see the original letter as a caustic reaction to a diversifying industry, one that's starting to challenge institutional norms that have protected bigotry, it says. And it says the examples of censorship or being canceled alluded to in the original letter may be real in some cases, but are not a trend. Now, the Harper's letter, the original one, was spearheaded by the writer Thomas Chatterton Williams, who was on this show last week, mostly about something else, his article in The Atlantic on how the failed coronavirus response in the U.S. looks from France, where he currently lives. But we touched briefly on his letter. Here is 2 minutes of that exchange.
We try to stress in the letter that the canceller-in-chief is Donald Trump, and I think the most high-profile person that's been publicly canceled in the past few years has been Colin Kaepernick. So it's not just a problem on the left, but when the left is trying to correct for the very clear and present danger presented by the authoritarian right, there's a danger that the overcorrection can harden into an intolerant dogma that we also experience too.
I guess in the news the last few days has been Trump trying to identify with the critics of cancel culture by standing up for Confederate statues, as well as others, but including Confederate statues. Is that relevant to your letter?
That is completely irrelevant. And someone like Donald Trump is not a good faith actor. He's not a good faith participant in the kind of debate that, speaking for myself, I was trying to participate in and that I'd imagine any of the signatories is attempting to participate in. Confederate monuments are not being canceled. There shouldn't be monuments in the United States of America to a side that fought against the country, to traitors of the Republic. That to me is a false equivalency with the kind of thing that we're talking about here when Colin Kaepernick cannot work for having a political opinion that he expressed freely, when you have people like David Shore who get fired for sharing, simply for tweeting research. You know, that was one of the most egregious examples that happened recently. You have the chairman of the board and the president of the Poetry Foundation forced to step down because their statement in support of Black Lives Matter, in support, I stress, was not considered strong enough. They have lost their jobs for what was deemed to be too tepid of a response. You have the same situation on the board of the National Book Critics Circle. These are worrying examples of a kind of authoritarian and intolerant drift in our nation's cultural and media institutions.
Thomas Chatterton Williams on this program last week. Joining us now are a signatory of the Harper's letter that he organized, New School professor Claire Potter, author, among other things, of a new book called Political Junkies, From Talk Radio to Twitter, How Alternative Media Hooked Us on Politics and Broke Our Democracy. Maybe you heard her book interview on that the other day. And a signatory of the response letter, Malaika Jabali, a public policy attorney, writer, and activist whose writing has appeared in The Guardian, Essence, Jacobin, The Intercept, Current Affairs, and elsewhere. So, Claire, welcome back. And Malaika, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
And Malaika, since we played the Thomas Chatterton Williams clip as prelude, why don't you start out and say why you think the response letter was needed?
I think it gets at what we are really trying to demonstrate, which is that there's hardly any analysis of power when we're talking about these interpersonal grievances within quote unquote cancel culture. And so I think it's important to frame this more broadly in terms of what cultural institutions are we talking about. So we're talking about a media industry and a literary industry where over 80% of book publishing is white. Editorial roles are nearly 80% white. You have conservative talk radio that has now kind of shifted into like YouTube and social media spaces. But in the early 2000s, conservative radio was 90% white, and that was largely due to our laws and our policy that made it easier for conservative voices to be heard.
In fact, to your point, let me set you up for another answer, because your response letter was called a more specific letter on justice and open debate. And your critique that the original did not get specific, just dealt in generalities, you take some of those claims point by point. I will read the 6 points that you cite with question marks so our listeners get it. Number one, editors are fired for running controversial pieces, question mark. 2, books are withdrawn for alleged authenticity. Journalists are barred from writing on certain topics. Professors are investigated for quoting works of literature in class. A researcher fired for circulating a peer-reviewed academic study. The heads of organizations are ousted for what are sometimes just clumsy mistakes. So the question marks indicate, I guess, really those things are happening as trends. Would you like to take any one of those and say why you think the Harper's letter got the context wrong?
Yes, absolutely. So when we talk about editors being fired for running controversial pieces, that seemed to be talking about James Bennett, the former, as the letter states, the former opinion editor of the New York Times. And he wasn't fired. He resigned because Black staffers rose up. A lot of this was happening on Twitter, which seems to be the point of ire for many of the signatories. So they rose up on Twitter and said that actually this defied certain journalistic standards and norms. And so in the midst of a pandemic, unprecedented unemployment, brash police violence, and we have a problem with repression because we're seeing it every day in our lives and against journalists, activists, etc. We're seeing all of this happening. And so there's a call for more truth, or a more military presence in these cities where these protests are happening.
That was the Senator Tom Cotton email that the Times ran.
Correct. And so it wasn't just a problem that he is, you know, having this exchange of ideas. Beyond it being violent, it didn't meet editorial standards because Bennett said he didn't even read the piece and he resigned. He didn't, you know, get fired. We could talk about number 2, books are withdrawn for alleged and authenticity. That was because an author who got a $7 million book deal apparently plagiarized a number of passages in the book. And on top of that, she was stereotyping Mexicans. So a free exchange of ideas is one issue. But the other is, are you actually doing your job poorly or not? And so if people are doing their job poorly, and they're having this information, it's a free exchange of false ideas, of plagiarized ideas, then that deserves some consequences. And she didn't lose her book deal. She just got ratioed on Twitter. She has a $7 million book deal. And unfortunately, people like to conflate these experiences with some sort of slippery slope of fascism that we're actually experiencing on a daily basis.
So Claire Potter, New School historian, why did you sign the Harper's letter? Give us your point of view.
Well, I would like to start by saying that a lot of the things that Malaika is saying, I absolutely agree with and support. I think one of the issues that the letter raises is that free speech norms support people with power and actually can exclude marginalized people. I think that's absolutely true. And I think we always have to be talking about who has access to free speech and why. So that's very important. That being said, one of the reasons I signed the letter is that I do not know a woman journalist today who does not shy away from stories that are going to cause her to be harassed online. Jessica Valenti actually had to shut down all of her social media and leave her platform for a period of time because she was getting so many death threats and so many threats to her children and her family online. So actually, the toxic quality of online conversation is a huge problem for free speech. And I think digital alternative media and social media in particular raise questions about barriers to free speech that we really haven't dealt with as a community of journalists or as intellectuals. We haven't dealt with the fact of what does it mean to call down trolls on people. And I would like to acknowledge that people who opposed the Harper's letter, some of them were viciously trolled, right? What do we do about the wild spread of misinformation by people who are actually committed to social justice but have their facts wrong and have a kind of network that is going to put that misinformation out there to tons of people? So I actually thought it was very important for a group of us to stand up and say, we are disturbed. I would also like to say that the nonspecific quality of the letter was very, very deliberate. I'm not surprised that people read themselves into it, but James Bennett is not the only editor who has been fired for an editorial misstep. Deadspin editor Barry Pachesky was fired in 2019 for an article that he published that was controversial. An editor at Harper's, James Marcus, was fired over the Shitty Media Man story. So actually, the desire to sort of grab onto one powerful man and say all of these people are defending him is an assumption, and it's a reasonable assumption, I'm sure, given that it's been in the news. But actually, this is a much more pervasive phenomenon.
I want to get into the fact that so many luminaries of progressive politics, I think it's fair to call them, as well as literature and other things, sign the original letter that's getting the backlash. This is a Gloria Steinem, Noam Chomsky, Bill T. Jones, Margaret Atwood letter, among others. And Malaika, the list of luminaries on the original letter certainly made a lot of people look. Gloria Steinem, Wynton Marsalis, Margaret Atwood, Noam Chomsky, for heaven's sake, Salman Rushdie, Bill T. Jones. What do you think people should think about it? Think about, you know, that list in the context of your group's letter, because I know you had a certain take on it.
Yes, I think for the most part, I mean, looking at the wide array of people who signed the letter, it's obviously going to represent a wide array of reasoning behind it. And believing in, again, kind of taking it in the abstract, these norms of free exchange of ideas and democracy and liberalism is completely fair on the face of it. When you hone in on it, and I do think that examples are important because we're not just talking about, we can't talk about anecdotes if we're also arguing that this is something that's widely occurring. So if this is a wide occurrence, then at least provide some data. And so without data, all we have to rely on is trying to guess at the examples. And so you can say broadly that these values are important. I believe we all believe that they're important. It's easy to agree with. What's hard to agree with is how do we handle a system that has systematically oppressed a lot of the people who were the subject of the example. So if you talk about, again, sending in troops, if you talk about Mexicans at the border who were, you know, the subject of American dirt, if you're talking about a wide host of people who are on the left who are being, you know, deemed intolerant, if you're looking at the people who are responding to David Shore, who are actually saying that, you know, we are receptive and we want people to listen and learn, these are folks who are experiencing systemic oppression because of centuries of censoriousness, centuries of a fascist police state, and yet those voices are not included in the letter. There's another conversation that Claire is talking about that we can have, but that's not the subject of this conversation because we're talking about a letter that did not include those examples.
Mm. And so is that to say that even a Gloria Steinem, even a Salman Rushdie, even a Margaret Atwood don't get it, whatever it is, on some level because of the positions of power that they've attained, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they, who knows what each experience was. I don't know if everybody read the letter in full. Maybe they didn't think about the implications of it. Maybe they didn't think that it would get this kind of pushback. Or maybe they didn't think about the specific examples and ask and question, you know, what exactly are we debating here? Because if you just take any logical example, if you have a conclusion and you have a premise, there has to be a B. A plus B equals C. So yes, we need these values. C, you know, you have people who are being fired maybe for questionable reasons, but B, what's the cause of that? Are people resigning or being fired because these you know, the woke left actually caused it, or did they resign for other reasons? And when you look closely, a lot of people resigned for other reasons or lost their jobs for other reasons.
Before we take a few phone calls, I do see that you both tweeted about Barry Weiss resigning from the New York Times. She alleges bullying by her colleagues in support of a political orthodoxy as a central reason. Claire, I see you tweeted, will Barry Weiss haters now be satisfied? And Malika, I see you tweeted, Barry Weiss being able to quit her job on some made-up grievance in a global economic crisis is peak privileged. Claire, you want to go first on what you think the departure of Barry Weiss? And for people who don't know, she's kind of a conservative-leaning columnist at the New York Times, or was. So, Claire, what do you think the departure of Barry Weiss signifies?
Well, first of all, I think that Barry Weiss is an excellent example, if Malika wants data, of P.T. Barnum's phrase, there is no such thing as bad publicity. I don't think it matters what Barry Weiss does. She will always prosper through it. And, you know, part of what I was saying in that tweet is, do we all recognize that every single time you're tweeting about Barry Weiss, you're giving her more publicity and upping the number attached to her next book deal? So I think that's one feature of it. I also think what Malika is pointing out, which is oftentimes people are embedded in very powerful structures. Of course, that's true of Barry Weiss. She came up through the conservative media machine, which is something I talk about in my book, that there are a series of institutes and foundations and so on that cultivate people like Barry Weiss from a very, very early age. She started doing what she's doing in college. So I think whether Barry Weiss stays at the New York Times or not is sort of irrelevant to anything. What I do think, and I would like to support something Malika is saying here, these powerful institutions have very, very complicated dynamics. To the best of my understanding, there's a great deal going on at the New York Times that is roiling around that provides useful context for a number of these departures that we will never know anything about because HR departments aren't allowed to talk about them. So I think that. But I also think that Malika's question about data, while laudable, is not something that a statement of principles is likely to contain, in part because you move to abstract principles to try to reset the culture, to try and reset the nature of conversation. Those of us who signed the letter absolutely knew there would be pushback. I almost never sign documents like this anymore, mm-hmm. and it really depends on whether I can mm-hmm. handle it or not. Right. Had I known it was coming out on the day of my book release, I might have even thought harder about it. But that being said, of course we knew there would be pushback, and right. that is why we joined together right. to do it.
Anna in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling, Anna.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, hi. I'm calling with respect to something that was said at the beginning of the segment about how these instances of cancellation are isolated incidents and not trends. And I am a young person, and I am calling essentially with respect to the way that cancel culture has affected youth culture. And I think that young people have learned how to be political through cancel culture, and they've learned how to become political voices and how to use their voices and of activism, and how to essentially be political selves in an era of cancel culture. And I think that I've noticed specifically on social media has become extremely dangerous. And this idea of assassination of character, and not cancellation by necessity, as it is often when people's voices need to be heard and this is the only way that they can have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially using social media and using the idea of cancel culture, or the kind of groundwork that these kinds of movements have built and laid, in order to kind of like foster a culture of fear and foster a culture of kind of constantly dragging people down. And I think that is what I'm worried about.
Malaika,
the way that... Oh, of course.
Sorry, just... yes, let's have you two talk to each other a little bit. Malaika, you want to talk to Anna?
I think it's completely fair to be concerned about people being torn down in public spaces without us adequately listening to their views and allowing for kind of democratic debate, within reason, of course. Because we know that, you know, it can go really far where people might deny, you know, slavery or the Holocaust. I think we're past those types of debates, or people's humanity and whether they're deserving of it. And so within reason, I think that it's fair to say that is a problem, to not be able to listen to people openly. At the same time, we're kind of talking about different things. We could talk about Twitter mobs who might attack a music artist, but you brought up political figures. And if we're talking about politics, then millennials and Gen Z are facing the worst economic crisis that previous generations have ever experienced. We're talking about institutions of power that have taken away, you know, their ability to buy homes and to live well and to have health care. And mm-hmm. we're in the middle of a pandemic, a crisis in which Black people are dying at three times the rate of other people. And so, yes, I think that these are important, but kind of the alarmist attitude around cancel culture is a little bit disconcerting when we have all these other things that actually do contribute to people wanting to cancel. People mm-hmm. are frustrated.
Anna, a quick response, Anna?
Oh,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think I just wanted to clarify. I wasn't talking about people sort of voicing their opinions on political figures. I was more so talking about young people attacking each other. I think I was talking more about, less about the things that people are saying about the situation right now. And I completely know mm-hmm. all of the economic mm-hmm. crises mm-hmm. as someone was a 2020 graduate. But I think what I was talking about is the way that young people have kind of like learned to speak and like learned to understand their what their voices mean, and using that to attack each other.
Anna, thank you so much. And please do call us again. Desiree in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Desiree.
Hi, yes. So I just wanted to say very quickly that I actually think that Claire and Malaika are talking about two different things. I'm a librarian. I have worked with young people, and the way that people communicate with each other on the internet, on social media, is a very different thing from the canceling of free discourse, right? Canceling somebody on the internet because you don't like what they said is a very easy thing to do. It's asynchronous. It's anonymous. It is sort of part of the social media platform because people can do things so easily. They can respond so quickly without thinking. But the idea of silencing public debate, silencing discourse, silencing dissent, to me is very disturbing. And I think that that is why, and that's what I took from the original Harper's letter, was that it was sort of approaching the idea of, as a community that believes in free speech, that believes in the power of individual voices, you should engage discourse that you don't like, words that you don't like, speech that you don't like, with more speech, not by silencing.
Desiree, thank you very much. So let's wrap this up with each of you saying, if you think this exchange that has been taking place, you know, here in these few minutes, and also in the media sphere generally, social media and professional media, since the Harper's letter and the response letter came out last week, can all this back and forth lead to something good? Claire Potter, you first.
Absolutely. I think all free speech is actually, all discussions about free speech lead to more thoughtful behavior around free speech. And I would say, I not only welcome the response to the letter, but I welcome all responses to the letter. Each one of them has made me think, has made me refine my ideas, has an occasion helped me change my mind. But I actually think that citizens in the United States have to start to think about what they are supporting when it comes to forcing us into two very, very different boxes in a kind of, you're either with me or you're against me. If you said this bad thing, you're obviously a bad person. I think that's a kind of extreme place to go that is stifling to free speech and leads us to a situation in which we are almost paralyzed in how to actually deal with the kind of discourses coming out of the White House.
And Malaika Jabali, you'll get the last word.
I think that we can acknowledge that we're experiencing repression. There can be intolerance, and we don't need additional voices that are going to continually marginalize voices that are marginalized and using broad terms that don't get into the imbalance of power that we're seeing play out in this space. You know, when you have dozens of people who are being charged with felonies for protesting, when you have a history of Black people who are not allowed to read and write in this country, if you want to take it back further, censoriousness is a problem. But if we only focus on the left, who have relatively very little power in this country, if any, we don't have any Congress people, for instance, or senators who are in the left, and we are run really by a conservative and centrist government, we lose sight of what really matters here. And I just hope that we can focus on the material conditions, the material lives that are lost and damaged when we use stereotypes against people who are marginalized.
Malaika Jabali and Claire Bond Potter, thank you so much for this dialogue.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.